The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to keep on top of all the news out of China, especially if you subscribe to our daily email newsletter, SubChina Access. Or check out subchina.com for all the original reported stories, op-eds, great regular columns, and our growing range of videos and podcasts. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today, as always, from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Jeremy Goldcorn was unfortunately too slammed with finishing up the week's work before the Chinese New Year holiday, so he's unable to join. Like many people who do a lot of writing, I have tried my hand at fiction, but I always find that the plots or the authentic dialogue or the characters or the conceits that I dream up are never as compelling on the page as they are inside my head. Our guest today, though, is somebody who is actually giving me a little more courage because she is living proof that the skills that you hone as a journalist really do better equip you for fiction writing, or at least they certainly seem to in her case. Toping Chan is a journalist with the Wall Street Journal, although I should say that she is speaking today in her capacity just as a fiction writer. She's now in Philadelphia covering the work beat for the journal, but until recently, and for many years, she was in China with the journal. Her collection, newly published, is called Land of Big Numbers. It's got 10 wonderful short stories, all either set in China or, involving characters from China and set elsewhere. But they are very affecting, inventive, beautifully written, and often very funny and, uniformly memorable stories. So, Toping, welcome to Cynica. Congratulations on the success of Land of Big Numbers and on the deservedly awesome reviews you've been getting.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on and for that amazingly kind introduction.
Okay, let's start off, I think we have to, with a little bit of your personal story. We're both Chinese Americans. I assume you were also born in the States?
Yeah, so our Laojia is in Hainan, but like many Americans of Chinese descent, my folks, we've got roots in Taishan as well as in Beijing, and we've got some Southern blood and Northern blood as well.
Oh, great. And you grew up where in the States?
I grew up in Oakland, California.
Oh, yeah, right. Bay Area. I went to Cal, so yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Brother Soul.
Okay.
And wait, Tucson, Arizona gets a name check in your book. I mean, one of the excellent stories in there. The couple actually live in Tucson. Do you have some connection to Tucson?
No, but I once traveled through there, and it just seemed like this really fantastical land. The colors are so vivid, and it all just seems sort of like a stage set.
Yeah.
The sky somehow more dramatic.
Yeah, I grew up there.
Oh,
I don't know
did.
If you know that. I spent, from 78 to 84 there, and then again from, 89 after Tiananmen, 89 to 96 there until I moved to China when I was in graduate school. I mean, I'm surprised you don't have a real personal connection because you got details of summer monsoons and, Palo Verdes and saguaros all perfectly. So
Yeah,
it was great to.
Thank you.
And then when did you go to China?
I first went to China in 2006 as an undergrad.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was at Capital Normal and later at Beijing Normal and went back to the country in 2010 on a Fulbright Fellowship, then was in Harbin and Chengdu, and ultimately made my way back first to Hong Kong in 2012 to be a correspondent there for the Wall Street Journal, and in 2014 moved back to the mainland and was in Beijing.
Oh, cool. So I guess I met you in that 2014 period when you had moved back and started working for the journal.
That's right.
And then you didn't get back to the States until just last year or 2019?
End of 2018 and we moved back.
End of 2018. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It was a really remarkable time to have been in China. So let's zoom in right now on your years there. You know, so did you have a particular beat when you were writing for the journal there, or were you just sort of general news?
General news. Yeah, I mean, with a little bit more focus on kind of educational system, environment, human rights, but it's a small team. We all covered everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, it was a great crew of people at the journal during your time there. Just really amazing people. I guess that was like the Jillian and Josh were both there at the time. And
that's right. That yeah. And yeah. Lori and yeah, many Lori, past yeah. guests of yours on this show. Amazing people to learn from and work beside.
Yeah, you were definitely overdue. But you're the first one to come on to be, you know, talking about a successful collection of short stories. So, yeah. I'm a huge believer. I mean, I've talked about it all the time on the show in developing a sense of empathy. And particularly of informed empathy, of cognitive empathy, especially, you know, when it comes to getting it right with China and the Chinese people who, you know, seem, I think, to many Americans and to other Westerners to just be so utterly different and have, you know, such a completely, you know, different lived experience and a different history. It's just so unfamiliar to Americans. So I feel like what you've done here, your ability to imagine yourself not just into one Chinese perspective, but into the minds of really multiple characters from such a diversity of backgrounds, of, you know, different genders, of different ages, of different social strata, different levels of, you know, sophistication or exposure to the West. I think that's got to be, you know, part of the reason why you produced such good journalism. I mean, can you talk a little bit about what the interplay is between your fiction and your journalism and whether you think, as I suspect, the one improves the other and probably, you know, the other direction as well, as I hope is true.
Yeah, so the interplay between fiction and journalism is such a good question. I think so much of the discipline of journalism, listening to people and finding the meaningful and looking for those telling gestures and voices that are so compelling and paying attention is those are exactly the skills of fiction in so many ways. And for me, living in China during those years, I mean, it felt like such a privilege to be a reporter there and to have the chance to get to immerse myself in so many different kinds of worlds within the country and speak to so many different kinds of people. And really, even before living in China as a correspondent with the journal, I mean, from the time that I first arrived as a student in 2006, I mean, it's just impossible to not be struck constantly and compelled by, you know, what the country has been going through. And so for me, journalism was a way, of course, that felt like, you know, a vehicle to tell so many stories about what was happening in China, but also just out of necessity. It was one where obviously the world is so winnowed down and it's interpreted through the lens of what is meaningful to a global audience. And all of that, of course, you know, the sorts of stories that we often would find ourselves writing in reaction to the news, dictated by high-level state policy and government actors. All of it compelling, but also a lot of it feeling almost incidental to what is so, you know, what felt like so much the heart of my experience in China, which was much more like the personal and the idiosyncratic and individual stories around me.
Oh, wow. I got to think that you must have been nurturing this idea of writing short stories from a pretty early time in your journalism career. Is that a correct suspicion, or was this something that happened only toward the end?
Yeah. So no, it really only happened towards the end. Had always, like, I'm someone who always had a million stories that I wanted to write as a journalist, and some of them, I mean, I took any opportunity I could to try and smuggle some fun and humor and some of that, you know, kind of more ground level color into our stories. I'm thinking I did one story about a pair of villages that were having sort of a tug of war over a bus stop, like digging it up covertly in the night and moving it back and
I remember that
to
one,
their
yeah.
entrance. Mm-hmm. You know, or stories about, the fad for students wearing wedding dresses on campuses, like during graduation, just all sorts of colorful pieces like that. But so I was, for a long time, I mean, I would be just picking up details like that and trying to put it into news stories however I could. And really, the short stories didn't occur to me until quite late, when I was actually working on a novel, one that I had started to write when I was living in Chengdu in 2011.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I'd finished it when I was living in Chengdu, and I don't think it was very good, but I had...
I'd still be happy to read it.
But I picked it up again. Like, I'd set it aside for some time, because after I wrote that book, I joined the journal, and I didn't have a background in newspapers, and so it was a lot to learn, and so I really just gave myself entirely over to the job. And it wasn't until, you know, years later, when I felt sort of more comfortable in the role, that I started to go back to fiction writing and working on this novel again, and was really wrestling with it. Felt like I just was having trouble getting back into it. It was also like historical fiction, and at some point it really just occurred to me that I could be writing about what I was seeing in contemporary China instead of, you know, grasping for details about 1930s Shanghai. And for me, I remember very vividly, there was one night when I was biking home from the bureau in Beijing, and thinking about the novel and sort of thinking about different phrases, and this one phrase, Shanghai Murmur, popped in my head, and I didn't know at all what it meant, or, you know, but it occurred to me almost like, maybe you're like this way too, Kaiser. Like, sometimes I, you know, when I was in high school, I think a lot about band names. And so sometimes I find myself thinking about storytelling sort of in a similar way. And so, yeah, I thought I would try and write a short story around it. And I ended up writing 10, which ultimately became this collection. And
so that was the first one that you...
That was the first one. Yeah.
So it would seem that just as your ability as a fiction writer made its way into your journalism, your experience as a journalist seems to have made its way now into your fiction. There are all sorts of, I mean, your stories, all 10 of them are shot through with references to real life things that, you know, made the news in China. Some of them well before you were there as a journalist, but, you know, during your time in China for sure. There's, you got your protests over land appropriation. You got young people being detained and dying mysteriously in jail. You got roundups of petitioners, you got your stock market crashes, you got your nail houses, you got farmers who build robots or airplanes. Mm-hmm. All these things, I think, would be really familiar maybe to people like us who've lived in China and were paying attention to the news really across the whole first couple of decades of this century. But I can imagine somebody criticizing the collection and saying, and some jaded reporter type saying, you know, that all of it feels shoehorned in. For the record, I don't think that's the case. I think that it all works. But can you talk about your decision to bring all of these elements in? Was that
entirely? Sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's funny. Obviously, there are stories in the book that are inspired by headlines, which I found myself at times almost using like writing prompts. Like, I'm thinking of one story about an elderly farmer who wants to build an airplane, which is just like a recurring motif of a story I felt like I kept reading in local news, and was always just so curious about and wanting to know who this person was, or, you know, who these people were and what their stories were, and drove me to write that one piece.
I'm pretty sure that he is exactly like the real deal. His everything from his tender relationship with his wife to his, you know, party membership aspirations to, everything. That was just great. That might have been my absolute favorite. I know it's probably not everyone's favorite, but I love that
one. No, I'm so thrilled that you said, I think of it as, it's like kind of the more off the radar connoisseur's choice. There's lots of opinions on which story is the favorite. I've heard really different views, but that is absolutely mine too. And I think for people who really have spent a lot of time in China, I've heard the same thing, because I do think it captures kind of a quietness and a tenderness that exists in life there, also married to just like this outsized ambition and but at the same time, like, so funnily pragmatic too, you know, this elderly farmer who just wants, never ridden an airplane, and he's just going to build one himself. Yeah,
it's so China. It's quintessentially China. I mean, I gotta say, I mean, most of the men in the stories don't come in for such good treatment. I mean, you got Chinese men in relationships with foreign women, like in the street where you live, and in Field Notes from a Marriage, and they're both murderers, or they're accessories to murder. I don't want to spoil it. You got this like sadistic and possibly quite totally psychopathic stalker dude in Hotline Girl.
I liked him.
Wow,
that's okay. Funny. No, that hadn't even occurred to me. Oh wow, no.
The American guy, even the American guy, Eric in Beautiful Country. I mean, he's like this casual adulterer. He's kind of
he's also kind of a jerk, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like the only truly loving, devoted, tender guy is the old farmer.
But what about Zhu Feng's father, who is just like, who you love. It's so funny though that you put it that way. It hadn't even occurred to me. And Zhu Feng, for all his flaws, is someone who I have a lot of affection for too. But no, you're right. There are absolutely darker sides.
that's a minor. It's not even a criticism. It's funny how I don't think I can remember having just read a short story collection and being able. I could tell you every one of them. I mean, I remember them all. That's pretty good. On an album, there's no lan ge. There's like not one throwaway track in there. It's awesome. Which makes it hard because I do want you to do a little reading, and it's going to be hard for you to pick one, I'm sure, to read. But we'll get to that in a bit. I got to ask you though. One of the things that I found really compelling about the collection and about a couple of the stories in particular was that I knew, or at least I really strongly suspected, that I was reading allegory or parable, right? Mm-hmm. But it was never at all on the nose, and I hate when it's on the nose. The fact that I am still not remotely confident that I've solved the puzzles at the heart of I guess the two most more fanciful stories, New Fruit and Gubeko's Spirit. Any chance you could give me a hint? Obviously the New Fruit, which produces these fascinating behavioral changes in people. Was there something in particular you had in mind with that?
I'm first of all so thrilled to hear that you didn't feel like they were too on the nose, or just that they were trying to hammer a message home. No, I don't think at all that they were intended to be didactic or to, and that was something, in the writing of a lot of these stories was, unlike journalism, the process of fiction writing is so much like getting to write and not strictly having, a script in mind or a destination and just writing towards something and knowing that something's there, but not always having set it out in a prescriptive way at the get-go. And so, with New Fruit, it was really just, I started writing it because I loved the neighborhood around me so much, and I wanted to almost write a story as kind of a tribute to it. Just these characters of these retirees around me, in and out of love, with all of their, their gossip and views on other people's lives, and in particular with the story and the neighborhood where I lived, it was inspired very much by the fruit that I would buy during the summer, and everyone else would, of course, the nectarines at the height of the season, which are just incredibly delicious, and very much as they are invoked in the story, though without the supernatural qualities. And I just loved them so much and found them so hypnotically good that it really was, as I was writing the story, suddenly this fruit was taking on all these different properties, and not to give any spoilers, but its effects shift too, right? They start out evoking all sorts of emotions for people, very positive, and it becomes almost this addicting thing in the neighborhood. And then the next season is different. Perhaps it was, the acid rain, who knows? But for whatever reason, the quality of the fruit is different, and it starts making people remember all these things that they want to forget. And it disrupts lives, it disrupts marriages. And I think it was just, for me, it was on the one level, a story very much just, again, trying to evoke a neighborhood and a side of Beijing that I loved. And on the other, almost without me meaning to, it did become this story about amnesia and forgetting and recovery of memory. And I think, that's something that seeped into the story, as so many of these sorts of themes did end up becoming
woven into these stories, not in any really conscious way, but just because inevitably, if you're thinking about modern China and trying to capture it, that's just, it's always there. And
right, the past, yeah. Wrestling with the past, burying exactly. The past, disinterring yeah. The past, right. I had a theory. I mean, I
would love to hear your theory.
Yeah, no, I mean, I felt like maybe you were, my instinct was, she's talking about social media. She's talking about how, you know, the thrill of the early advent of it, the sort of liberating quality, how everyone felt so great. And then, you know, just all the dark stuff that started coming out, all the problems of it, and how it was, you know, hiding us off into these little tribes and, you know, saying these really nasty things about us, about one another. And then, you know, it getting banned ultimately, or getting, you know, cracked down on really
hard.
Oh,
wow. I'm smiling. So, I love that interpretation. It hadn't occurred to me.
I'm glad it has. I would love to hear what readers have to say. And even more mysterious to me was Gubeko's spirit. I mean, which I thought was just a great, yeah. Another great story, but, about that train that never comes and people just sort of stuck in this station. You know, a lot of the stories reminded me of and then I'll definitely want to ask you about, you know, some of the inspirations for some of these or some of the other writers that we were reading. Like one of them in particular, I think probably not the first person to say this, but The Street Where You Live, I think people will immediately draw some comparison to George Saunders' short story collection and the eponymous short story, you know, that gives the collection its title, Civil War Land in Bad Decline.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read that? Had you read that?
Yes, I have. And George Saunders is an author I love.
Me too. Although I didn't ever finish Lincoln in the Bardo.
I've heard differing views. I love it, was, but I know.
Yeah, it was just kind of, yeah, I somehow didn't finish it. But I love
it. It might have ended up being two on the nose too.
Yeah. But I do, I mean, I actually love his nonfiction. I think he's just an immensely talented writer. So, I mean, while we're here, who are some of the writers you love?
Yeah, I love, in terms of short story writers, I mean, one of my favorites is Mailea Molloy. I love her work. I mean, it's not at all set in a place like China. They're set in, like, U.S. and often in sort of more remote parts of the U.S. But her writing is just so crystalline and beautiful.
I've not read her.
I mean, she's just the master of like two paragraphs in and you know everything. You just, she's evoked this entire world in a few strokes. I love her. Kazuo Shuguru is just a favorite writer too. George Saunders, who we mentioned, another writer who I really love, especially since we're talking about short stories, and was reading in the run-up to writing this collection, Carmen Maria Machado, who, I mean, I love her nonfiction, I love her fiction, her short stories are incredible. So definitely, you know, I think some influences that are more surrealist or magical realism, but... But others that, like Mailea Molloy or Kazuo Shuguru are more straight sort of realist writers.
Well, I'm really glad you gave us such a nice mix of surrealist or magical realism or whatever you want to call it and hyper-realistic stuff. I mean, stuff that was just so, you know, authentic and, you know, in which there was nothing that didn't ring as completely true. And I thought that was a nice mix because I wouldn't be able to sit through, you know, a whole collection of just magical realist stuff.
Sure.
But that's just me.
Yeah. Well, and I'm also just like, since before we move away from Gubeko's spirit, since you brought up that interpretation of New Fruit making about social media, as you were speaking, I was thinking it wasn't something that occurred to me at all, but it's something that you could apply almost to Gubeko's spirit, in as much as I think that story, commuters who get stuck in place and end up, you know, adapting in many ways, I think almost as... In as much as it is partly a story, I mean, it's a story about a lot of different things, and it's funny now, a number of readers have pointed out that there's a lot of parallels that you could invoke with regard to the pandemic and with so many people, you know, being...
That's what I thought, and I was going to ask you when you wrote that one. What was it during?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. It predated the pandemic.
Okay,
sure.
Oh, that was weird. I mean, because yeah. I, I, it, 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 it felt like, I mean, I was sure that that had to be it because, you know, in lockdown, unable to move right. forward, this is sort of frustration. And people who were so used to mobility and productivity and just like the breakneck pace suddenly having to wrestle with, you know, downtime, lots of it.
Right. But ultimately also, too, this like way that they end up crafting this narrative for themselves, like aided by state media, of how they're almost heroes and how important they are, despite the exactly. fact that they're literally living these, like, you know, very stagnant lives yeah. underground, which made me think of your social media comment, just because social media obviously has that same ability to, you know, make it feel like we're endowing ourselves with all kinds of, significance and meaning and superpowers. Yeah, precisely.
Well, no, so, but the one that is obviously about social media, though, and I think that does touch on that theme about maybe, you know, convincing ourselves that we're endowed with superpowers. And then, you know, the inherent real world dangers of so believing was Lulu, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really, obviously that was a great one to put first because I think it really set the tone so well. You made the decision to make Lulu and the narrator twins, which I think there was a really interesting idea there. And what I took away from that, and maybe I'm completely off, was this idea that there's actually very little that separates somebody who decides to be a dissident, to be a critic, and somebody who's kind of resigned to complacency, or not complacency, but just sort of, you know, who acquiesces.
Yeah, you know, I think,
how could they be any closer? If they're not.
Exactly. And I do think in some ways, right, like part of what that story does highlight, and there's a lot of other pieces to it, but one thing is just, you know, when you start to go down that path, I mean, it's not necessarily this dramatic fissure or a moment, you know, when you throw everything to the winds, but in her case, it was just, you see this evolution of a young woman going down this path, and it's the accumulation of little decisions.
But I mean, it's I love how you left it that ambiguous and how it is that slow accretion thing. I think one reader might come to this and see Lulu as just sort of heroic and her brother, you know, the narrator. So these are twins born and, you know, during their years in college. So he is sort of, you know, this guy who just plays video games eventually competitively, but, you know, he just works in a grocery store. He doesn't have, you know, a lot of ambition outside of sort of the soma, kind of the drugged, complacent and the stupor of video games. And then, you know, his twin sister, becomes this sort of online hero. But some people might see that, you know, the hero and the kind of the coward. Another reader, though, might see Lulu also as playing a kind of an online game.
Yeah.
An online game, right? I mean, it's one with higher stakes, but it's also in its own way kind of detached from reality. I mean, and then any number of other interpretations in between. But I love that you gave that sort of absence, I mean, that ambiguity and that absence of moralizing. I got to think that was intentional.
Absolutely. Right, and I mean, you picked up so much in that reading, and I'm so grateful. Yeah, maybe this also is an instinct from journalism, but just feeling like, you know, not wanting to draw these moral bright lines in fiction.
Exactly.
And feeling very much that you can empathize with everyone in that story. I mean, Lulu, with her sense of what she wants to do in this world and her importance within it,
a I love her
that you
husband.
Really can admire.
Or her,
and her,
her
husband.
Boyfriend.
Yeah. Oh, her husband breaks my heart. Yeah, that.
Oh, no, I love that guy. I mean, I know that guy. I mean, I feel like I know that guy. That guy's awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, that guy's sort of, you know, my kind of a masculine ideal in a lot of ways. really.
How so?
I just feel like, you know, he had so much obvious respect for her. So much admiration for her integrity, but at the same time was so, you know, kind to her parents and to his brother-in-law. But, you know, had spine and dignity. I mean, real dignity. I liked him a lot. But I think that story just kind of gets at this choice that really confronts every educated person in China. You know, I mean, when they have to weigh the exorbitant cost of dissent and you know, I think it's easy to understand from that story why so many people would simply choose not to go down that path, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think really wanting the reader to be able to empathize with that,
right? Because from a distance, I think it can be hard to try and imagine what these sorts of choices look like. And, you know, we see it both from her brother's perspective, but also like the parents too, right? Who see this is their daughter who's brilliant and has been in so many ways afforded the chances they could not have. And in their eyes, you know, is throwing it away on a symbolic cause.
Wow. We could do an exegesis on every single one of these stories because I really want. But I think what I'd love for you to do is give our listeners a taste of your prose. If you could just pick something maybe hopefully you haven't read in other on other platforms before. So
yeah, I'm going to read from the short story that Kaiser and I were just discussing, which is called Lulu. It appeared in 2019 in The New Yorker, and it starts like this. The hour of our birth had been carefully forecast, a winter's day cesarean, timed to coincide with Dr. Fung's lunch break. The doctor pulled me up first, indignant and squalling, like a hotel guest roused and tossed before checkout. Lulu came next and was so perfectly quiet that at first they thought she wasn't breathing at all. Then they thwacked her on the back and her cries joined mine, and they laid us side by side, boy and girl, two underwater creatures suddenly forced to fill our lungs with cold, dry air. Dr. Fung had operated on our mother as a favor to our uncle, his old classmate. Otherwise, we would have been born in the hospital down the street, where a woman had bled to death after a botched cesarean the previous year. The family had been in the waiting room for hours, and at last the father-to-be pounded on the doors of the operating room. When no one responded, the family pushed them open to find the lifeless woman on the table, blood pooling on the ground. She was alone. The staff had stripped the medical certificates that bore their names from the wall and fled as soon as the surgery went wrong. From the start, we were lucky, not least because we had each other. As twins, we'd been spared the reach of the government's family planning policies. For the first few weeks of our life, our skulls had matching indentations from where they'd been pressed against each other in the womb, like two interlocking puzzle pieces. Later in life, when we were apart, I used to touch my hand to the back of my skull when I thought of her, as of seeking a phantom limb. We weren't in any way an extraordinary family. My mother worked as a warehouse clerk, my father as a government sanitation planner. When he was 47, his division chief, a fanciful man who once dreamed of being an artist, decided to build a public toilet in the shape of a European clock tower. He'd been to Europe and had impressed by the cleanliness of the toilets and the loveliness of the architecture and wanted to combine the two. Like most artists, the division chief had a fragile ego, and shortly after my father balked at the project's expense, he was fired. It was the sole act of independence he'd committed in his life, and it cost him his career. From the time Lulu was 10, my parents worshipped at her altar. Her precocity was evident early on. It was like a flag being waved energetically from a mountaintop. Neither of our parents had much education, and it stunned them to find themselves in possession of such a daughter. When we were small, we played devotedly together. Lulu was a great inventor of games, which often incorporated whatever she'd read most recently. One day we were stink bugs looking for the right leaf on which to lay our eggs. Another, we were herdsmen fleeing Mongolian invaders. She was braver than me. Once, she even snuck into the apartment of the elderly woman who lived opposite us and had left her door ajar while retrieving the mails downstairs. "It's full of newspapers stacked as high as your head," Lulu said excitedly, eyes glowing as she dashed back to our apartment. "There's a giant orange cross stitch on the couch, with a peony and six fishes." As a child, she was always reading. Even at meals, she would sit and scan the back of the juice box. She must have read it a million times. Aspartame, xanthan gum, and red number 9. It wasn't a conscious thing. She just seemed to feel uncomfortable when her eyes weren't fastened to a page. She had a mania for lists, too. By 11, she'd memorized every bone in the human body, and she used to recite their names to me at night in an eerie voice as I held a pillow over my head. Sternum, tibia, floating rib. In high school, I rebelled against her brilliance by playing video games, lots of them, spending hours whipping a gun back and forth across dusty landscapes empty of people, except for those who wanted to kill you. Usually there were 6 or 7 of us at my friend Xingjian's apartment, and we would take turns and cheer one another on. We were an army, invincible. Or if we weren't invincible, we could hit replay at any time, which was pretty close to the same thing. Lulu, meanwhile, was a model among model students. She studied so intensely that it left her physically bowed and exhausted, like an athlete running a daily marathon, and at night she dropped off to sleep without a word. My mother fed her stewed mushrooms that looked like tiny brains when their stems fell off. They would be good for Lulu's studies, she said. She gave some to me as well, though by then it was plain that any hopes for academic glory resided with her daughter, not her son. The constructive effects of mushrooms be damned. When we sat for the college entrance exam, it surprised no one that Lulu scored high enough to earn a place at a university in the nation's capital, a bus and a train and a plane ride away. My mother wept with what she said was happiness. A scholar, she kept saying, a scholar. She and my father, she liked to remind us, hadn't studied long before going to work in the factories. We are so proud, my father told Lulu. There was an intensity in his expression that unnerved me. One of our school books had a black and white illustration of a long-ago eunuch serving a feast, staring hungrily at the food on the emperor's table, and there was something of that look in my father's face. The night Lulu left was overcast, the twilight that preceded it a peculiar mixture of orange and ochre. Earlier that day, my father had given her a gift, her very own laptop. It was thick with promise, like a fat slice of cake, sheathed in blue plastic. It wasn't like the old computer that we all shared, which stuttered and stalled, its keys sticky with grease and crumbs and bits of hair. This one had keys that yielded obediently when you touched them. I'd stared at it enviously, too filled with longing for words. Don't worry, you'll get one too when you leave, the exact same, my father said. At the airport, our parents assumed expressions appropriate for refugees being abandoned at a border. Lulu, be good, my father said. I stood there awkwardly, a little resentfully. Lulu turned and flashed a peace sign as she went through security, and we watched her pink hoodie and striped zebra baseball hat retreat into the crowd until she was gone.
That's great. I think this gives just such a good example. I mean, there's already so much in there. I just jotted a couple of things down. Two interlocking puzzle pieces. That already, I mean, that's so fantastic, just that complementary thing, that the two of them, these are not shaped the same, like puzzle pieces aren't, mm-hmm. right? You have one that is concave and one that's convex, and that already sort of hints at these, the really pronounced difference between their two personalities, but the complementarity of it. The European mm-hmm. clock tower toilet thing, again, ripped from the front pages. I mean, ripped from, you know, from the architectural, like, hilarity of China, right, with all the...
And Chinese public toilets in particular.
And then just the stark contrast of having that outward appearance of whatever, you know, foreignness, modernity, and then it's a toilet, right? And then, like, the transgressive nature that Lulu has just from childhood, you know, breaking in or sneaking into the neighbor's apartment and then, you know, finding this, you know, the pack rat woman with all the newspapers stacked up to the ceiling. Yeah. That was. And then this whole theme that comes back again. I mean, there's a couple of them. You know, obviously, her ability to recite all the bones in the body, that comes back in rather tragically later on. But also this theme of the ability to hit reset or to hit replay mm-hmm. that, you know, he can in his games, and Lulu can't in, mm-hmm. in what she's playing at. And then one more thing that I thought was just hysterically funny, which it was great because you didn't explain it and you didn't need to, which is you flicked at that Chinese medicine theory that the resemblance of some food to an organ is good for that corresponding organ. And when I read that, I was expecting like this explication, you know, saying, oh, you know, because of the theory and blah, 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 and that you didn't do that was a delight to me. I was so glad that you didn't. But see, I think that just that little passage for listeners, this gives you some idea of the riches within here. It was so fun to just, you know, move through this collection slowly and to kind of delight in the thought that went into it. So it was just great. Another theme that I want to talk about, and this surely must be drawn from your own life, from your own experiences in China, from your own maybe relationships, the cultural disconnect between China and the U.S., right? I mean, yeah. It's something that I'm constantly experiencing, I mean, in my marriage, in my life, watching the world around me. It's in, obviously, Field Notes, in Beautiful Country, the street where you live, where you have, you know, American characters and Chinese characters in juxtaposition. You do this, I think, too well for it not to have been drawn from personal experience. Can you talk about that?
That's so funny because, yeah, I mean, I've thought about that. And I don't, you know, it wasn't something I had thought so consciously about until people started asking me. And I realized, I mean, I have a lot of, obviously, you know, being Chinese American and then living in China and coming back to the States and all those frictions that that experience entails in both locations. But in so many ways, the stories that you mention, Beautiful Country and On the Street Where You Live, those moments of disconnect felt to me just actually like the I can tell you there were moments there that were perhaps more so than other bits in the book, like they were things that I'd seen in my own life, but I think they were more really just universal disconnects between humans, like men and women in a relationship, in love and not in love, and you know that moment in which you find a lipstick in your lover's car and you're trying to talk yourself out of, you know, what you know it means, and that feeling of coveting someone so desperately, as we see the one man do in that story On the Street Where You Live, to the point that he moves into her apartment and all of her old cast off objects that she's donated to the Salvation Army, he goes back and retrieves because they acquire this aura of specialness just having been associated with her. And it's funny too, I think of the title of that story, which arrived late, but you know, right, in many ways
from My Fair Lady.
That's right, yeah, exactly. On the Street Where You Live, because and that song is so much about that feeling, right, of just loving someone so fantastically that suddenly around you it just imbues the ordinary with this feeling of magic. And yeah, I mean, I think some of the disconnects that we see in that story are very much that of being an immigrant and out of place. But truthfully, when writing them, I mean, I was really channeling more, I would say, experiences that just
right.
happened
that
to
one
be,
didn't
yeah,
feel
very,
like
very
yeah that one for sure that one that he didn't have to be Chinese for that story
absolutely
to work.
Yeah,
right, that one didn't I would maybe take that one out of that list that I gave. I mean, just because I was just thinking about, you know, how in a few of these stories there were Chinese and American characters
yeah.
interacting, but he was an odd duck anyway.
He was very odd duck.
Well, yeah. Henry, he would be sort of like Henry Higgins if Eliza Doolittle had fled and he didn't get a chance to transform his Pygmalion. Right.
Uh-huh.
But no, that was a funny, actually a really deeply funny, but also really disturbing piece. Humor comes in a lot, actually. I think maybe it doesn't come across right away in what we've been talking about, but it's shot through. There's a lot of just very, very humorous observations, and I want listeners to understand that that's the case. I flatter myself to think that people like us, you know, people who kind of have grown up biculturally and have lived biculturally, that we maybe have we're really attuned and able to recognize instances of cultural disconnect more than other people can. I mean, for whom it seems unbridgeable and even something that you can't write about with any kind of knowledge or experience or nuance. But I like to think that people like us who straddle these two cultures are maybe, you know, particularly well attuned to it.
I think that's, yeah, I mean, I think definitely always having one's antenna up and being really sensitive to those moments when maybe it's, you know, yourself or it's people around you, right? Feeling, if there's a feeling of not quite being at home or and always wanting to be attuned to that. And I feel like as a reporter too, that's something you're just always thinking about, how comfortable people are in a conversation or in a particular context. And yeah, but I think, you know, with Beautiful Country, like a lot of those moments of disconnect, they're ones that could be about class too, right? And in some ways about culture and that culture. And I mean that purely like just in a more universal sense of, right, you know,
right.
Someone who's raised in this very different context, her lover versus her, just I think that some of those are rooted in you could say an American versus a Chinese context, but also those are such vast worlds, right? And trying to distill it to those two is just hard and probably a bit imprecise. And I think and I hope, you know, what Land of Big Numbers is trying to do for readers in many ways is just, you know, help create the sense of a world that is so much more multi-layered and
there not being one cohesive sense of a Chinese culture or a Chinese story, right? That there's many of them overlapping and complex and conflicting at times and just shot through, yeah, with humanity and people's own individual wills and sense of themselves.
Once upon a time, I wrote a little column about how, pretty much every long-term expat who's been in China has a half-finished novel or screenplay on their hard drive. I think for people like me, and then the thousands of China-focused journalists or analysts or academics, and the other people who actually do kind of write for a living, a lot of us fantasize about publishing a novel or a short story collection one day. Do you have pointers for us? How did you have the gumption to just, I'm going to get an agent, I'm going to submit a draft. How did that all, I mean, what advice would you have for us?
Yeah.
Because I'm chicken shit about that stuff. I'm so...
Well, for me, I think the collections just emerge out of a sense of desperation, really, just like this feeling, this really pent up feeling of like being so struck and compelled by this world unfolding around me and like this desperate desire to try and capture it in any way that I could, and loving journalism, of course, but also feeling that I could only ever capture one fragment of it through news stories. And so for me, it was, I think feeling that sense of urgency was really like what carried me through this process, right? And carried me out of that novel that I had been sort of sunk and mired in. I think, and once they were written, you know, just going back over them a million times and trying to improve them until I was stuck and couldn't figure out anything else to do. And then at that point, you know, reaching out to an agent to see if it would be possible to try and get someone interested in the collection. I will say it was something that like felt really inaccessible and something that was really illuminating, especially before I started trying to think about submitting it possibly to publishers, was like, I started to educate myself about the process or tried to anyway. And immediately it was just like, it felt like this incredibly discouraging thing because you start reading and you're like, everybody knows each other. Like you look into the acknowledgments of these books and everyone's like, they're all friends or have taken each other's classes or each other's students, and not having done an MFA or like really knowing any, not having friends who were fiction writers. It felt super alienating and inaccessible. And I will say just like, I think this experience left me feeling like it really was much more possible than I had anticipated.
Well, that's encouraging.
Yeah, so my advice would just be, yeah, go for it.
You just have to feel that desperation. I have yet to actually feel quite that level because there's just so much in everyday life that keeps me just so distracted and busy. But that's just fantastic. I got to ask, when's the next, what's next for you in fiction? I mean, I always look forward to reading your writing, your journalism, but are you planning anything, a new project? Resurrecting that 2011 book on 1930s Shanghai?
Yeah, well, you're inspiring me to want to open it up and take another look. I always have ideas. I have one novel that I'm playing with right now. And
oh, great.
We'll see where it goes. Yeah.
Don't want to jinx it. Never want to jinx it.
Yeah, never want to jinx it. And especially just, yeah, I've never really been comfortable talking about this stuff. So all this is new and novel, no pun intended. But I've just been so thrilled that the book has had the reception it has, and just to know that people are reading it in different places, including Hong Kong, mainland China, that it's meant something to them. It's been really moving.
Well, I'm going to send you some of my shit and see what you think.
I look forward to that. I'm so excited to read.
All right. I mean, my terribly on the nose parables and my
I love it. I can't wait to see what Kaiser's awesome. Thinking in the 90s and what scenes he was documenting in a fictional world.
Yeah. I'll send that to you soon. Congrats once more on the book. I can't wait to read more of your fiction. I think you found your true calling. As good of a journalist as you are, I think you found your true calling. Yeah, let's move on to recommendations. My pleasure. So let's move on to recommendations, but first a quick reminder that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina, and the best way to support the work that we do with Seneca and the other shows in the network is to subscribe to SubChina Access, our daily newsletter, chock full of links to the day's important China news, to the good stuff on SubChina, and much, much more. A couple of housekeeping things. Let's see, on Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern going forward, Jeremy and I will be hosting a little room on Clubhouse, that app that everyone's talking about. I will probably do another one later that same evening, most Fridays, for our listeners who are in China who won't have gotten out of bed at such an ungodly hour, but especially on a Saturday morning. But the Friday 5 p.m. room will feature a roundup of the week's important China news, as well as, you know, a chat with a recent Seneca guest. I hope to ping you're able to join us for one of these. That would be awesome. Previews of coming shows, and of course, questions and comments from the floor. We did a little trial run really recently, and it was, I have to say, it was a success. Although Clubhouse crashed from, you know, too much traffic, or maybe from, you know, meddling from certain state actors who are not pleased with the way Clubhouse has played out. anyway, I have my suspicions, but anyway. Also, two shows to tell you about, new ones. Our new China Stories podcast features long-form stories and op-eds from some of the best English outlets covering China. Our partners at present include Sixth Tone, Caixin Global, The Wire China, which was founded by David Barboza, former New York Times correspondent and just a fabulous writer, and The World of Chinese. If you like audio but hate to hear the Chinese names and tones butchered, subscribe to China Stories. You will love it. And our newest network member is You Can Learn Chinese, a podcast produced by the good people who bring you Mandarin Companion. John Pasden and Jared Turner, just two of the nicest and most knowledgeable people there are when it comes to Chinese language learning. It's not a Chinese language learning podcast per se. Instead, it's you know, it doesn't teach you the language, but it's a podcast about learning. About learning Chinese with all these tips and techniques, methods and mindsets, lots of moral encouragement. Also features interviews with non-native speakers who have managed to learn Chinese, including Jeremy and myself. We've been on the show before it joined our network. So do check that show out. Subscribe to You Can Learn Chinese and to China Stories. Finally, one of my absolute favorite network shows, Strangers in China, is back for its second season, and it's going to be even better than the first season from what I've heard of it so far. The show's producer and host, Clay Baldo, is just a natural podcaster, an amazingly empathetic storyteller. You'll love his production, his sound design, the people and the topics that he features in this radio magazine format show. So check out season two of Strangers in China. Okay, on to recommendations, and sorry for going on for so long. Tuping, what do you have for us?
I've got two recommendations. One is just a short story collection, which I just love so much.
Oh, yay.
The title is What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky by Leslie Rima. It's wonderful. And the other recommendation they have more for this particular audience would be My Country, My People, which is a book on China that I love. From it's a collection of essays from the 1930s. Some of them are really anachronistic. It's by Lin Yutong, and though some of them are anachronistic, others, many of them, just feel so like as though they could have been written
exactly.
Yesterday. They really resonate.
Lin Yutong is great. I love the guy. He was such a fantastic voice back then.
Yeah, he's going to go back to so often.
Really, really good recommendations. Actually, I have a copy of My Country, My People. I'm going to dust it off and crack it open again. I haven't read it since grad school.
It's always worth revisiting.
Yeah. Since we've been talking about fiction, I want to recommend a novel by Christopher Biha. It's called The Index of Self-Destructive Acts. It's set in New York around the time of the financial crisis, 2008, 2009, and it's about baseball, it's about finance, it's about journalism, it's about the quantification of the world, it's about love and ambition and race and the internet and much, much more. I guess I'd give it like an A-. It's not perfect, but I definitely think it's worth your time. I really enjoyed it, and I do recommend it with, minor reservations. Tuping, thank you so much again for your time. And this beautiful reading. I'm going to be, singing the praises of this book loudly. And I really highly recommend people pick up a copy for themselves and enjoy it. And then go back and re-listen to this podcast. Once you've done that, I think you'll pick up on a lot of it. You'll get more out of it having actually read the collection. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much. This has been amazing. Thank you so much for having me on.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network, including the three that I've just talked about. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.